Blog Talk Radio.
And good afternoon, listeners. This is John Gresham from Fairfax, Virginia, where it is a beautiful, crisp fall day. And I just love this time of year. Having grown up in Southern California originally, I've never failed to look in awe and wonder at the leaves changing and just the change of the seasons. We'd ever had those in Huntington Beach, where I grew up, but today is certainly a fine example of that. And in the spirit of change and evolution, we're going to do a show today about the changing nature of naval warfare. I don't think I have to tell anyone who's been alive for the past 20, 25 years that the United States came out on top in the Cold War. And one of the benefits of that victory, if you wish to call it that, was that the U.S. Navy became the dominant force in the world in terms of sea power. America was, for many years, and to some degree still is, the great single superpower in the world. And our Navy is arguably the most powerful in the world. So the question arises, if you're a regional power who wishes to become a regional superpower or something bigger, how do you go and operate on the sea lanes without incurring the wrath of the mighty U.S. Navy? And there is something new in the water, and this is an idea that has only recently been formalized, though it has roots going back in history, and this is the idea of campaigns based around a warfare tenet called Anti-Access Area Denial, known by the convenient acronym of A2/AD. It is a strategy which goes and does not directly confront. It is much more like asymmetrical warfare, similar to what we've seen terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda use, but in a maritime context. And to try and give you folks out there a sense of what this is all about, and oh, by the way, just how many nations are preparing to use these kinds of operational ideas and tactics, we've got a author from the U.S. Naval Institute Press, Mr. Sam Tigridi, here to talk about this very area. Sam is the author of the new book, Anti-Access Warfare, Countering A2/D2 Strategies, and we're going to have him on for the hour today. So without further ado, Sam, are you out there?
Yes, I am.
It's good to have you with us today. Let's start by Go ahead.
I said thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with your audience.
You're very, very welcome. And I guess my first question is, who is Samuel J. Tigridi?
Oh, well, first of all, it's not Samuel. It's just Sam. Sam J. Tigridi. Sam J. Tigridi spent 30 years as a naval officer. I'm retired from active duty. During my time, I served as a surface warfare officer and commanded USS Harpers Ferry, among other assignments. But on all my shore duty assignments, I served as a strategic planner or in international relations billets. And I had the fortune during my naval career to earn a PhD from University of Southern California in that field. So had a lot of opportunity to deal with the defense issues and developing defense strategies and naval strategy. So that's my background professionally.
And you're currently living out in the San Diego area, correct?
Yes, I live in Coronado. My office is only a few blocks away from the aircraft carrier piers at North Island, and it's a wonderful 73 degrees right now.
If you will forgive me, sir, I hate you because Coronado is heaven on earth as I know it.
Yeah, it's a lovely place. With the number of tours in San Diego, eventually it became home here. I came out in 1981 to serve on an aircraft carrier. So it's before the Reagan buildup and back when single officers did not get any housing allowance. So I lived on the ship and Coronado became the area of San Diego that I knew best.
Very good. Which raises a question. Obviously, you've seen a lot in the way of sea power doctrine, tactics, ideas come and go in your naval career and lifetime. What has caused you to go and reach out and write this book on this emerging warfare idea and area? What is it that actually caused you to want to go and write this?
Well, this is my fourth book on defense strategy. I've experienced this topic starting in about 1991, which is when the term anti-access originated, and we started using the term after that. So I'm very familiar with the topic. It's been one of those issues I studied during my active duty career. And there's been a lot written about this topic as far as reports and a lot of press reports and op-eds, primarily focused on the technology aspect. The big concern is, of course, the People's Republic of China, and they're developing anti-ship ballistic missiles, which, quite frankly, many press reports and op-ed pieces make sound like a formidable challenge that makes aircraft carriers and other surface vessels, surface warships, obsolete. That's a great overstatement. But what I wanted to do is write on the strategy of anti-access and talk about, is this a viable strategy? Has it been used in history? How has it been successful, or how has it been defeated? And the thing that I find is that, in fact, yes, it has been a strategy used in history. And this is not just a naval strategy. The primary focus of anti-access warfare is to defend land territory. It happens to be that geography dictates U.S. forces, if they're getting involved in any other region, have to travel by sea. The deal of the conflict will be maritime in nature before we reach another nation's territory. So that is the impetus for nations to adopt this strategy. The whole point of the strategy is that the nation, the potential enemy, does not want to fight U.S. forces on the ground. This is a lesson learned from the Gulf War of 1991. If you allow U.S. forces, joint forces, into your area, next to your territory, they are going to defeat you. So therefore, the goal is to prevent them from getting into your territory. This inevitably involves naval conflict, and also air conflict. As naval strategists, we consider the air above the sea to be part of the naval environment. So the whole point of anti-access is to prevent the United States from bringing its forces in the region so it can have a decisive effect on your prevention. That is the focus of their defense investments, not necessarily building a force that could defeat the U.S. on the ground, because the assumption is you can't defeat the U.S. forces on the ground. So that's the whole purpose behind an anti-access strategy.
And for our listeners, if you want to call in and talk to Mr. Tangredi or myself, our call-in number is area code 347-945-7246. Again, area code 347-945-7246. So the context that A2AD is being sold into in the present day is based around the notion of we're going to use the navies that we have in the waters adjacent to our homeland to go and deny the United States or some other regional power the ability to come in with maritime forces and deliver their land forces, correct?
Yes, but it's not just naval forces being used by the anti-access power. And by the way, I'd like to tell you that I do not use the A2AD term. I use the term anti-access. Later in the show, we could discuss the policy reasons that I don't. But as a practical reason, away from defense specialists, A2AD does not gain traction with people who don't study strategy, because it sounds too much like R2-D2 and C-3PO. And most people know the Star Wars trilogy of movies more than they know about naval strategy. So I don't use those terms. I simply use the term anti-access, because that's a basic underlying strategy. Now, getting back to your question, it's not simply a question of the anti-access force using naval power. It's also using forces on land, primarily ground-based missiles, and also land-based aviation to defeat the incoming forces. So this is much broader than naval strategy. It is joint. But on the other hand, it is joint only to a certain extent, in the sense that defeating an anti-access strategy really doesn't necessarily involve ground forces or heavy ground forces. That comes in the next phase of the war, if there is a next phase of the war. And I'll talk a bit about that when we talk about scenarios.
Okay. So let's start by explaining what are the features of an anti-access campaign. In other words, if you're China, or if you're India, or if you're Iran, or one of the other countries that does not want the United States or some other power to start delivering ground forces onto their land, what are can you break it down by phases? Can you go and do a structured timeline of what to expect in such a campaign?
Yes, John, but before we do the structured timeline, I'd like to explain a little more about the fundamental elements of their strategy.
Please do.
In the book, that is the basis of my approach to studying the strategy. And the five elements as I see it, the first one is the perception of the strategic superiority of the attacking force. And we've already discussed a bit about, basically what we're talking about is the fact that the attacking force is rated as strategic superior. You don't want to use it in your territory. I mean, you don't want it to come into your territory. I'm getting some background beeping, John. Do you hear that too?
I do, and I think that's on your end, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think that's on my end, which is most unfortunate. Let me try to resolve that.
Please stand by while Sam works out his phone problem here. And for our listeners, anti-access warfare is important because we have built a force in our Navy and our Air Force which is primarily based against conventional threats. Asymmetrical threats have proven to be a tad more difficult for us, especially in the context of counterterrorism, as well as going and trying to deal with small and otherwise irregular naval forces. Good example of this, the piracy problem off of the coasts of Somalia and in the Red Sea, where what looks like one day a fishing dhow can the next day be a boatload of insurgents with AK-47s and RPGs trying to go and grab a container ship or some other sort of valuable merchant vessel with cargo. And so dealing with this kind of threat is becoming more and more relevant to the United States Navy. And we will talk hopefully with Sam here in a second. Let me see if I can get him back on. Hello, Sam. Are you back with us?
Yeah, John. Am I coming through?
And that sounds much better.
Yes.
Well, actually, let's use this as a kind of a lesson about anti-access technology. Technology breaks down, and part of the anti-access threat, as perceived by a lot of strategists, is advanced technology weapons, such as the Chinese anti-ship ballistic missile. And in fact, a lot of the research, and this is one of the reasons I wrote the book, a lot of the research is, in my estimate, very superficial. There's a study done by someone who I respect and a friend who, for example, tosses out the headline-grabbing thing as aircraft carriers cost billions of dollars. For that same amount of money, China can build 140 anti-ship ballistic missiles, which it could fire off. Why that is superficial is because in order to detect a moving carrier and moving ships at sea, you have to have means of detection, which generally means some sort of satellite sensors, some sort of long-range radar sensors, some command and control system that could provide the information, and that's what costs the money, not the actual weapons themselves. If you fire off ballistic missiles in the blind, you might be lucky, even though the these anti-ship ballistic missiles are supposed to be equipped with the capability of changing their trajectory based on radar and IR signatures. You have to know where the enemy forces are to begin with. You have to beat them in order to create the engagement. And the money, the expenses, is in those systems, not in the weapons itself. So to say that they could build X number of anti-ship ballistic missiles for an aircraft carrier misses the point that they're going to have to pour probably $1 billion into the system just to detect the carrier operating to a point that they could actually have a targeting solution. That's where the expenses are. So the headlines that you read about People's Republic of China or Islamic Republic of Iran being able to strike carriers, I know the issue in the Arabian Gulf, Persian Gulf, is different because of the smaller distances involved, and we could talk about that a little later. But what you hear and what you read in the op-eds is very superficial. For example, what if you put deception systems on the ships so that you try to spoof the enemy's information system? What are they going to do with their missiles then? Again, if they fire them, they're going to be fired off in the blind or on the wrong targets. So does the anti-ship ballistic missiles make the U.S. concept of operations obsolete? Certainly it could if we're not very smart. But if we're smart and we put deceptive systems on our ships, and we had these systems on board during the Cold War. Now, they certainly weren't as sophisticated as we can build now, but we were pretty good, and all this is classified, and I'm not privy to all the information, but we were pretty good about being able to deceive some of the Soviet detection systems. And in that case, if we want to counter anti-access systems, deception plays a great role. And that's one of the areas that we need to concentrate on.
Okay. So anti-access is more than just really sexy weapon systems like ballistic missiles. It's also infrastructure. It's also training. It's also doctrine. What else is it?
Well, it is a totality of a strategy, and let me talk a little bit about getting back, since we had the technical glitch, getting back to the five principles I was talking about. The number one, as I said, is the perception of the strategic superiority of the attacking force. That's why you want to adopt an anti-access strategy, because you're afraid if the attacking force actually gets a foothold, they're going to defeat you. Now, any defensive strategy would not want an attacking force to gain a foothold in your territory. the difference in the anti-access concept or building your strategy, defense strategy on anti-access, is that the nature, the degree that you believe the opponent is superior, strategically superior. And, again, that's a lesson coming from Desert Storm. Clearly, once the U.S. forces were in the theater, it was just a moment of it was just a matter of time for the Iraqi forces. The second element is the primacy of geography. You try to use geography to your best defensive efforts. Now, again, that's pretty standard for any military operation, but the idea of the geography is to influence the time of the time structure of any possible attack, and also facilitate attrition of the enemy. And an anti-access strategy, as an anti-access force, you're not so interested in defeating and wiping out the enemy force. What you're trying to do is trying to delay it. And the reason you want to delay it is to be able to achieve your objectives before the out-of-area force, the counter-anti-access force, as I describe it, can actually influence what you're doing. This primacy of geography means that the maritime space, the maritime domain, becomes your primary, your predominant conflict space. Why is the fact of geography that 72% of the Earth's surface is water, is most of it ocean, and the U.S. is oceans away from those potentially hostile states that we may have a conflict with, and so maritime domain becomes a conflict space. The other, the fourth element, and I've already talked about that, is the criticality of information and intelligence, and conversely, the decisive effects of operational deception. But fifth, and this is a critical factor, is what I call the determinative impact of extrinsic events or unrelated events in other regions. And this is where you talk about the totality of the anti-access strategy. You were having a conflict with China or Iran. One of the things they would want to do is use diplomatic an economic influence to create problems for the U.S. throughout the world, to try to try to create a divergence between U.S. and U.S. allies, to try to convince other nations that it's not in their interest to host U.S. forces, and those are the other tools to keep the U.S. out of the region, and they play a critical role. Particularly in the historical examples of attempted anti-access strategies, and we could talk about that a little later.
Now. For example, would Saddam Hussein's use of Scud missiles against Israel in an attempt to bring them into the war in 1991 be an example of what you were just talking about?
Yes. A fairly limited level, but yes, that would be, because what The goal wouldn't be to defeat Israel or even create much destruction, since he didn't have the capabilities of that. The goal would be to inflame the Arab-Israeli conflict by having Israel strike back, and then other Arab nations perceive that as a strike against Islam or perceive that as Israel trying to impose its power in the region, and then they would take actions against Israel that are not directly related to the conflict between Iraq and the United States. They would be what I call extrinsic events. Now, the goal of Iraq were to generate these events, and sometimes extrinsic events are not generated by the anti-access state. They happen because of other factors, but they are factors that influence the decision. Now, let me give a historical example. And in the book, I go through historical examples. The major analysis is on three, what I call anti-access victories, three anti-access defeats. One victory was in the case of World War I, the Turkish defense, of the Dardanelles, the Turkish Straits, and the prevention of Allied forces from being able to enter the Black Sea in order to free up, in order to bring the Soviet grain supplies and connect with the Eastern Front so that they could outflank the Germans and Austrians, the three major powers that were fighting there. And what happened was the famous landing at Gallipoli, a great legend for Australian and New Zealand military, and certainly we've seen movies on that, and books have been written by that. The British and the French started that campaign as a indirect attack and to try to create and support the Eastern Front. But to them, that was not the critical point of the war. That was kind of a sideshow. The Turks were never able to push the Australians into the sea. The forces there, the British Empire forces there, were firm on the ground. There was a considerable amount of attrition battle, but the Turks were taking as much damage as the British-led forces. In fact, the Turks had plans to burn down Constantinople, now Istanbul, rather than letting it fall into the enemy's hands. The British did not know the extent of weakness, logistics weakness, the Turks had. And the time, the anti-Axis strategy of the Turks was to cause the British to give up that effort, primarily because it was too tough. And in fact, that's what happened. But the reason, primary reason was just because the battles on the Western Front was the focus of British effort. This was a sideshow. Since it didn't happen very quickly, the Brits lost interest, but decided it was not worth the resources. And that's really what an anti-Axis strategy is about. If the People's Republic of China were to apply it, they would most likely apply it in the Taiwan scenario, that is, a forcible annexation of Taiwan. Now, the goal of the anti-Axis strategy is not to defeat U.S. forces in some decisive battle. It's to prevent them from interfering with the mainland Chinese objectives. And if you could keep them out of the region, you could have a swift, decisive capture of Taiwan. Then what is the U.S. going to do? Does it intend to land amphibious forces on Taiwan and fight it and try to recapture the island with the support of whatever the remnants of the Taiwan forces are? That would be a very tough thing. What you want is to prevent the U.S. from being able to bring its naval forces in, to prevent your forces, that is the Chinese forces, from being able to cross the straits. And if you could keep the U.S. out, you achieve your objectives, that's where you want the war to end. You want it to end at that point. And that's when you use the diplomatic efforts and all various peace movements and that sort of thing to put pressure on the U.S. to not cause greater loss of life, et cetera, et cetera.
Can you give us a converse example where an anti-Axis campaign was not effective and, in fact, led to the defeat of the anti-Axis power?
Yes. The classic anti-Axis campaign is that of Imperial Japan in World War II and the Pacific War. The Japan did not strike at Pearl Harbor because it wanted to invade Hawaii or because it intended to invade the United States. It struck at Pearl Harbor in order to destroy as much of the U.S. fleet so that the U.S. did not have the power to come back into the Western Pacific and interfere with Japan's goals to invade and conquer the Dutch East Indies, Indonesia, to consolidate their control over Indochina, to continue their war in China and have greater gains. That's why they struck at the U.S. fleet at Pearl Harbor. Here's the analogy that I use, or the metaphor that I use in anti-access strategies. In anti-access strategies, if you perceive it as a chess game, you know, your goal is to prevent the opponent from capturing your king, because you perceive the opponent as being a better chess player, as being strategically superior. So what do? You knock the board off and the pieces fly off, and you prevent your opponent from bringing the pieces back onto the board. And in that way, they cannot capture your king. So what the Japanese tried to do is to knock the U.S. off the board so that we would not contest their objectives in the Western Pacific, that we would think that it's just too tough and that's not worth the resources. Of course, the Japanese miscalculated their anti-access strategy. If you see all the campaigns in the Pacific War, it was the U.S. advancing into Japanese-held territory, defeating the Japanese fleet, attriting their forces, recapturing what the Japanese were holding, and then eventually coming to the Japanese homeland, planning on the final invasion. And, of course, we did not because of the use of the atomic bombs. But that's an anti-Axis strategy, although the Japanese did not use the term. As I said, the term started, well, I would say it originated in 1991 as far as the use of the term, kind of gotten into the joint lexicon in the late 90s. But that's a classic anti-access strategy, Imperial Japan, that failed.
And this is the basis for Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto's famous comment prior to the outbreak of war to Prince Konoye about, if I am asked, I can run wild for 12 to 18 months, but after that, I make no guarantees.
Right. Yamamoto knew the United States. He had been an assistant naval attaché to the United States. He had studied at Harvard. He had traveled in the United States. In fact, there were assassination attacks him in Japan by fanatical army officers who believed he was pro-American before the war. Yamamoto advised Imperial Japan not to ally itself with Nazi Germany, but being loyal to his task and the emperor, when it was determined that they would go to war against the United States, and he knew the U.S. would defeat Japan in a long war, his strategy was an anti-Axis strategy in the sense of knock the chessboard over and convince the U.S. that they can't get back to the Western Pacific except at very high cost. And hopefully they'll decide that they can't expend the resources for it. Now, at the time, there are extrinsic events, that is, the war in Europe. And, what Japan hoped was that the war in Europe would distract U.S. attention, and we would focus on that so they can consolidate theirs. Of course, conversely, Germany, Hitler was hoping that the war in the Pacific would completely distract the U.S. and our forces would be focused there so that he could defeat the Brits, eventually the Russians too, in Europe without the U.S. committing great forces to that struggle. So that's where the extrinsic events part comes in. Of course, it failed, and the Japanese failed. Now, why did it fail? It didn't fail necessarily because of technology, although the U.S. did continuously develop different technologies. For example, the systems for amphibious warfare and the like. But it primarily failed because the U.S. refused to give in. The anti-Axis goal, as I said, is to create the situation where time and extrinsic events convinced the opponent to give up their effort to break through the anti-Axis defenses. That failed. The U.S. was not going to give up its effort. Anti-Axis strategies fail.
Yeah, to put it quite bluntly, when they made the opening move at Pearl Harbor and other places in the Pacific, they really pissed off the United States, and we were not going to get weary for a long while of the fight.
Right, is what I refer to as the Pearl Harbor Syndrome. And that's what a lot of potential nations that might be hostile to the U.S. often don't understand. What they do is they focus on the great noise in the U.S. press concerning concerning peace movements, the need for diplomatic solutions. And because most of the nations, in fact, all the nations, well, I won't get all the nations, but most of the nations today who would adopt anti-access strategies are authoritarian states. That's one of the reasons that they have hostilities to the U.S. Many of them just don't understand free press or the fact that all this noise in the media doesn't necessarily reflect official positions and doesn't necessarily reflect the general attitude of the American population. So they are often confused. That happened to some extent with Saddam Hussein. He heard that, and he concluded that the U.S. would not be firmly resolved in the Gulf War, and the big issue of the U.S. Population not being able to accept large numbers of casualties, and he thought that he could create attrition on U.S. forces. In fact, he talked to U.S. Ambassador April 4, invaded Kuwait, and said, look, the words to the effect, the U.S. cannot stomach 10,000 casualties in a single battle. Well, the U.S. didn't have 10,000 casualties in a single battle. In fact, the U.S. Allied casualties in that war were about 250, a little less than 250, of which I believe around 170 were U.S., many of them killed by blue-on-blue so-called friendly fire. And so his miscalculation was amazing. Now, we don't consider him having enacted an anti-access strategy, because he did. He led the U.S. into the fort, into the region. And the lesson learned by China and then the then Soviet Union was, and other nations was, if you let the U.S. into the region, they're going to defeat you. So you have to base your entire defense strategy about preventing the U.S. from entering the region.
You very succinctly early in the program talked about the fact that anti-access is not just about hardware or software. It's an overarching concept in which you build specific capabilities to do specific things within a context of your own needs and such. What are good examples of anti-access systems? We obviously talked about the DF-21D, the anti-ship ballistic missile. What are some other intriguing or interesting anti-access systems, and are there anti-access systems? A good example of that being the American Littoral Combat Ship. Take it away.
Okay. The roots of the anti-access concept lies within the Cold War. The Soviet Union was not able to build a sea control navy. They built a sea denial navy. That is, they could not, their perception was that they would not build, at least till the latter parts of the Cold War, a navy that was sought to contest against the U.S. on a global basis. What they wanted to do, several things. One, in a war against NATO in Europe, they wanted to prevent the flow of forces from the U.S. and Canada to the European theater. How do you do that? Primarily, you use submarines, attack submarines. We countered that by trying to prevent the Soviet submarines from operating below the Greenland, Iceland, United Kingdom gap, the GIUK gap, so that they could not interfere with that. But then when we went into the maritime strategy, which was intended to pressure the Soviet Union on its periphery so it could not commit all of its forces to the Central Front NATO battle, that's when we really came up against their anti-access systems. What are the systems? Primarily attack submarines carrying cruise missiles, long-range bombers carrying cruise missiles, land-launched cruise missiles if we were within the range of that, a smaller fleet, but ships designed for high attacking power, and their whole design is not focused on survivability, but to what the Soviets used to call the struggle for the first salvo. That is, being able, high striking power, sacrificing survivability for these surface platforms, many of them smaller than the U.S.'s platforms. Time, you would have potential for using land-based ballistic missiles against ships at sea. In fact, ASBMs were initially developed by the Soviet Union. What happened in that case, ASBMs are intermediate-range ballistic missiles. And eventually the U.S. and the Soviet Union came into an agreement in Europe, that's the famous agreement concerning Pershing 2s versus the Soviet intermediate ballistic missiles, to ban that category of missiles. So that effectively ended the Soviet anti-ship ballistic missile program, since it's an intermediate range ballistic missile, not a long-range ballistic missile type systems. And that's true of the Chinese. Of course, the Chinese were not a party to that agreement, so that's why they continued developing that. And ironically enough, those who have seen the DF-21 say it's very much similar in their estimate to the U.S. Pershing 2 intermediate range ballistic missiles, so that there's great irony in that. Anyway, that's another tool that can be used. So it's a sea denial navy backed by, depending on the range of U.S. forces, land-based aviation, particularly bombers carrying cruise missiles, and then ballistic missiles fired from the land against sea forces. Later, when the Cold War ended, we actually found something that we did not believe to be true, although Soviet sources talked about that, that there was a potential for the Soviet Union to launch nuclear-armed ICBMs against U.S. fleet concentrations, and that they actually thought about that and considered that. And at the time, we just looked at ICBMs as strategic weapons to deter. And, in fact, if a power like Iran developed a nuclear weapon and actually used it in combat, they would use it in an anti-access mode, that is, against U.S. forces in the region. Now, that immediately engages the Pearl Harbor syndrome, and I would think that would be a mistake. The U.S. has such a vast nuclear arsenal against anybody else, with the exception of Soviet Union and eventually possibly China, although they're not at that stage yet. So, but conceivably, that's what you would use nuclear weapons in a tactical engagement to do.
Okay. And that said, let's talk a little bit about, you talk about a number of hypothetical campaigns in your book. Give me an example of one or two of those so that our listeners can get some sense of how such a campaign might flow against the United States if we were trying to go and forcibly enter a region.
Yes. Well, the toughest scenario, of course, is China invasion of Taiwan. They will want to keep the U.S. out of any area of within range of supporting Taiwan. It's not to fight a war with the U.S. It's to present the U.S. with a fait accompli. We've achieved our objectives. Now it's time for peace. Yeah. You know? So in defeating that, one, we have to maintain some survivable forward deployed forces within that region. Primarily, the most survivable are, of course, submarines. If you can maintain, and I'm sure we do, maintain attack submarines in the region on a routine basis, then you have a survivable platform that can strike back and also try to close down the Strait of Taiwan so that the Chinese cannot bring amphibious and land forces across. So that's number one. Number two is you would want to maintain surface vessels there kind of as a tripwire, and also to influence the Chinese that their attempt at the objective of Taiwan. The other thing is, of course, we maintain regional air bases. And although regional air bases are much easier to target than moving ships at sea because you don't need that great location detection surveillance targeting system, you know where the land base is, so you just plug in the coordinates of the base into your ballistic missile and fire it off. And you could use GPS to improve your target solution. You don't need, you already detected where the base is. You know where it is. It's a geographic coordinate. It's a much easier thing to attack. And that's why the land bases are much less survivable. But the land bases being in place on host nation territory is a great disincentive to start a war with the United States. The other thing that we would try to do is blind their sensors. And that's why in the book I talk a bit about ASATs, anti-satellite weapons, and the fact that an opening phase in any anti-access versus counter-anti-access campaign can include the blinding of the opponent's satellites. And that's something we haven't, that's something that we have thought about, but because of the whole perception that satellites are needed in for nuclear deterrence, that's an issue that really hasn't been studied to a great deal. The people who very pro-arms control don't want to raise that issue. You know, they don't want a war in space, as they would call it. But that would be one of the first features of a major anti-access campaign. Try to knock down the U.S. satellites. Conversely, we would want to knock down their satellites. That way that you've created, if you're able to knock down your opponent's satellites, they lack the targeting information. They lack the capability of determining where your maritime forces are. And in the U.S. case, if the Chinese knocked down U.S. satellites, they try to deny targeting information from forces on the ground. The DF-21 is a mobile missile. To strike it, for us to strike them, we need to have information on where they are. The U.S. sensors are blinded. We would not have that information. And that's why the fourth element in the anti-access strategy definition and element decision making is the criticality of information and intelligence and information.
Okay. Now, let's talk a little about the debate over anti-access, because as you say, the term and the ideas are not new. I mean, the term, as you say, began to appear after 1991, after the Gulf War. Similarly, the idea dates back, as you point out in the book, to the times of ancient Greece, the Armada. Lord knows how many people have used the kinds of tenets that you talk about to go ahead and defeat a larger, more powerful nation. What are the merits of an anti-access campaign in the minds of naval analysts versus what are the downsides in the minds of others? How does the balance of rhetoric and debate over anti-access sit as we are sitting here today and your book is coming into publication?
The debate, first of all, about anti-Axis today very much involves the question of where defense resources should be spent. Much of the debate has focused about the large expense. You're talking about $10 billion or more of building aircraft carriers and whether aircraft carriers are survivable in an anti-Axis environment. Much of that isn't necessarily an argument about whether anti-Axis strategies would be used. It's a question of resource allocation. And in that, you have a number of factors. You have people who think that the defense budget is too large and that and then cutting a program like that is useful in reducing the defense budget. But even bigger than that are service parochial issues. That is, if we have a shrinking defense budget, what are we going to cut? Are we going to cut aircraft carriers? Are we going to cut F-35s? Are we going to cut heavy land forces? So the part of the debate about anti-Axis is a surrogate for those sorts of issues, which are often not raised because we live in a world of jointness or the ideology of jointness in which all services are supposed to be involved in everything and pretty much get an equal share of the pie. If you start talking about anti-Axis strategies and say, wait, the wars of the future are not going to be World War II type wars of massive forces. There are going to be wars, even the wars of necessity, as opposed to wars of choice. I use the term war of necessity. War of necessity is a war in which U.S. interests and U.S. position of the world is directly challenged. Involvement in Syria is not a war of necessity. It's a war of choice. What happens in Syria is not going to affect the U.S. global position or, you know, security of the U.S., with the exception of the possibility of Syria as a location for terrorist groups in the same way that Afghanistan functions. But even in wars of necessity, such as against, let's take Iran in the situation. Iran's objectives would be to close the Strait of Hormuz, to basically blackmail the world, to allow them either the elimination of sanctions or any other objective because of the economic impacts on all other nations. That's a limited objective. Iran is not going to come. There may be terrorist attacks using proxy, but that's not their objective. Same thing with China. China isn't intended, isn't looking at to capture Hawaii. It's got a limited objective, and its goal is to keep the U.S. out of the forces, out of the region, U.S. forces out of the region, while it tries to achieve that objective. Now, the big debate is not would China do that in that sort of scenario. The debate is more about where should we put resources, and it really has the army on the defensive. Because the scenarios I look at, logical wars of necessity, don't involve heavy forces unless we intend to take on a major commitment. I mean, I cannot see the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. I can foresee the U.S. clearing that is pushing the Iranians to see a march on Tehran in a conflict with China. I don't see vast land armies, heavy land armies, fighting in China on the Asian mainland. When you talk about a possible anti-Axis war with Russia, which would involve some sort of conflict in the Russian near abroad, that is the Central Asian states or Russian pressures against the easternmost NATO states, again, heavy land forces wouldn't necessarily be involved. That's probably one scenario that they might be, but may not. Another scenario is North Korea, and obviously land forces would be involved. But that scenario revolves around nuclear weapons, and it revolves around a last gasp, what I call a spasm war in which a crumbling North Korean leadership decides that they're going to go out with a bang. And in going out with a bang, hopefully that will cause other nations to help them retain control of their society, because they don't want the chaos and destruction that's going to result. So those are limited objectives, and when you look at them, you see that there are not a call for certain forces, such as heavy land forces. And that becomes a resource issue, and that's going to be fought in that. So as I said, I'm going back to my main point. The debate over anti-Axis strategies isn't necessarily a debate over the strategies themselves, because it makes perfect logic. These nations believe the U.S. to be strategically superior, mostly because our logistics and transport capabilities, being able to project our power globally, which they cannot, then that makes perfect logic. And it's hard to debate against that and say, well, no, that's not the strategy they're going to employ. What the debate is a surrogate for how the U.S. Department of Defense is going to spend its resources. And that's where the debate really comes out. Now, LCS earlier, and I'll talk about resources and the whole LCS. I'll be quite frank. From the beginning, I was a great opponent or one of the people within the Navy who said LCS is not a program we ought to embark on. It doesn't achieve our aims because it's not survivable by any means in an anti-Axis or even a littoral environment. The term littoral combat ship is a misnomer. It doesn't. LCS is basically a multi-purpose auxiliary ship. That is, it can perform as designed, it should perform a mine countermeasures capability, modest perhaps ASW capability, but not necessarily a tactical real-time ASW capability, because LCS can't defend itself. You bring LCSs into the theater, and I'm going to destroy them using air power pretty quickly. One of the reasons the CNO, Admiral Greener, wanted to deploy them early to Singapore is because at least we get some value out of them by being tripwires, by being kind of our equivalent of a Yangtze River gunboat. They're not going to survive, but they're going to create their, but there's a deterrent factor of attacking them, because you're going to create a much larger war by doing that. But as of themselves, to me, embarking on that program was quite a mistake. It's not a ship that's going to be multi-purpose. We haven't figured out what sort of strike weapons we could put on it. It's so far away from Admiral Sobrowski's vision of a highly armed, small, striking vessel that can operate in the littoral to take on enemy forces such as those who would be part of an anti-Axis campaign. One of the reasons the U.S. Navy adopted it is because in the Rumsfeld Pentagon, the watchword was transformation. And LCS appeared to be a transformational vessel in the fact that be modular. That is, you could pull the systems off fairly quickly, put different warfare-type systems on it, and it could perform a different mission. But there's a lot of limitations in that. The other reason was because, and Admiral Vern Clark was the CNO then, is because we wanted to keep up fleet numbers. Destroyers are very expensive. At the time, it was envisioned that you could buy 3.5 LCS for every destroyer. Well, guess what? That was an unrealistic estimate. And in fact, you could probably buy 1.5 LCS for the cost of a destroyer. So considering how much striking capabilities destroyers have against LCS's minimal or non-existent striking capabilities, that equation does not make sense. But when the program was adopted, we thought we could pump out LCSs in greater numbers. For every 10 destroyers the U.S. fleet would include, you could put out 35 LCS. Well, I and a number of other then-serving officers thought that unrealistic, over-optimistic assessment. And, in fact, it is.
Okay. Well, we're coming to the end of the hour, and I want to thank you for coming on and talking to us about both anti-access warfare and your book. I guess as we close up, I'd like to ask, what's next for you? Do you have another book project in mind? What are you going to be working on?
Well, I work for a planning consulting firm called Strategic Insight. They're actually located in Washington, D.C., in Crystal City, right above the metro. And their specialty is strategic planning for projects of great complexity and risk. It was founded in 83 by three gentlemen who worked on the Early Aegis program with Admiral Meyer. And I think we all have to agree that the Aegis program is probably the best managed defense acquisition program, one of the best that's ever been, not simply in terms of money, but in terms of the length of the viability of the system and how long and how it's been upgraded even to ballistic missile defense capabilities. Well, anyway, they started the company. I work for them. I work on a whole variety of strategic planning process. Most all of the people are systems engineers or acquisition specialists, program managers. I'm one of the few policy type guys. So that's my day job that pays the mortgage. The books are, some of them, the anti-access book, some of the research is from things that the research I did when I was on active duty, some from spin-offs from projects for the company, a lot of it done on my own time. My upcoming project, and I do have a book contract for that, is a study of the future of aircraft carriers. And let me talk a little bit about that. There's so much controversy about the survival of aircraft carriers. I proposed to the publisher that I would do what in medical research is called a meta-analysis. That is, you gather up all the studies done about it, you put them together, you see, you compare and contrast them, and you see what is the general conclusion. And that's something I have done in my Futures of War research in previous books, gathered up what everything that other people have said that makes sense of it as a whole. Well, when I started this project, I was expecting to find all sorts of studies on survivability of aircraft carriers in various scenarios, their value as opposed to land-based aviation, all these things there, the cost of those programs versus costs other defense programs. And I was startled because such studies don't exist. There are very good studies like the RAND Corporation on whether the U.S. should build the Gerald Ford class as opposed to more Nimitz class carriers. There are studies that list, compare like cost growth of the program versus cost growth of other programs. But there is no study, amazingly enough, that takes on what I, the 10 areas of comparison that I'm applying, such as comparing the capabilities of aircraft carriers and survivability versus other surface ships with Tomahawk missiles, comparing the survivability and ability of the carrier versus land-based aviation, comparing the cost of the program and the output of the financial investment versus other programs such as F-35 or other, you know, land-based programs, comparing aircraft carriers' survivability against anti-access weapons in contrast to other type forces, and all those various elements. Apparently there's nobody who's done that, and so that's what I'm working on. And I was very surprised because there's so many op-ed pieces, there's so many articles in defense literature that just assume Carriers are not survivable. We need smaller ships. Or carriers are not survivable to shift from forward deployed defense to CONUS base, perhaps conventional ballistic missiles with fast intelligence to provide quick striking power. There's plenty written on that, but it's all assumptions about the future of the aircraft carrier. So that's a project I'm working on now, and hopefully
we'll look forward to what the result of that study is. Sam, thank you so much for coming and joining us today, and hope we can talk to you again soon sometime.
Yes, and I have. I really appreciate the opportunity. Sorry for the technical glitch. And I have one request of your listeners or yourself or whatever. Like all authors, I would like a large audience for the book. It's a very specialized book. And the way of getting a large audience for whatever book these days is getting a little more controversy so that people pay attention. So if anybody there has connections with the Chinese embassy or the Chinese military, I could get them to denounce the book and say, this is a dangerous book or something, that would be great to get people interested in reading it. So if anybody has
well played,
the opportunity,
Mr. Gangreve, well played.
Let's do that.
All right. Well, listen, you have a great afternoon, and we've got to close up the shop here for the day.
Okay.
And with that, we come to the end of another session of Military Monday. We look forward to having you listening to us again next week when we will have a doctor of chiropractic coming on to talk about going and providing treatment and care to wounded warriors and vets over the past few years. I hope you'll join us. Please take care. This is John Gresham signing off for Military Monday.